Don't see any nodding heads. Okay, before I switch the agenda, just because the people online didn't hear, I'm proposing that we switch to item 7, the public hearing for Santa Cruz now, unless somebody's here for an earlier item. Otherwise, I'm going to defer them later. Is anybody here for an item other than the Santa Cruz item? And can you hear me? So that was a nod yes for you can hear me, but no nod yeses for, okay, I think I got that. Okay, so I'd like to proceed to item 7. Siri, could you introduce that, please?
Oh, public hearing for docket 24-001, City of Santa Cruz Interim Variance, Project Site, Resource Recovery Facility 605 DeMeo Lane, Santa Cruz, California. Chair.
Before we get to testimony, I'm going to ask for an offering up of all names that are going to speak or likely to speak so I can put them all under oath at the beginning. I can always add someone later if something comes up. So for the district, it's the two of, oh, we have them here. Oh, thank you for that. Wow, that's quite a list. Mm-hmm. And I'll apologize in advance for any names that I may or may not get exactly right. So I'm going to ask now everybody on this list and then ask each person by name one at a time and then ask them to affirm. And if you're sitting and not near a microphone, you're going to be asked to get near a microphone to make your affirmation. You swear or affirm that the testimony you're about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And I will start with board staff, Amy Climo.
Yes.
Mary Gerardo.
Yes.
Armando Jimenez.
Yes.
Thank you. Poi Yu.
Yes.
Thank you. Nathan Nguyen.
Yes.
Okay. Bob Nelson.
Yes.
Okay. Guadalupe Sanchez. Okay, is Guadalupe Sanchez present?
She might not be here.
Okay, so it's okay. I'll just can't have that person testify without putting them in under oath later. Barbara Choi.
Yes.
Thank you. Kendra Kent.
Yes.
Thank you. Nat Israel.
Yes.
Thank you. Paul Stout.
Yes.
Thank you. Juan Carbajal.
Yes.
Thank you. Okay.
Can we add my name to that list, please?
Yes, we can.
Yeah, Kevin Crossley, City Santa Cruz.
Kevin, do you swear or affirm that the testimony you're going to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
Yes.
Thank you.
There we go.
Is that with the C? Kevin, is that with the C? So at this point, I'll just tell people the order that we're going to go through. We're going to ask the petitioner to present their case. Then we're going to ask the staff to present a report. We are going to have a chance for public comment. I will remind our commissioners, as always, they're welcome to interrupt at any time for questions, although we try to maintain as much flow as we can. And let's start with the petitioner presenting the case, please.
Hi, I'm Hoyu. I'm the associate engineer for the City of Santa Cruz Public Works Department. The city runs their own resource recovery facility, which includes a landfill, recycling center, and we have C&D, and we also prime woodways. We also contract with a third party vendor that runs our gas collection facility. That contract has been in place since 1984. On February 20th, 2024, we got a notification from them telling us that their plant has been down since February 5th, 2024 because of PG&E equipment failure. And the equipment failure, I think, is like a high wind event where it knocked down their direct transfer trip and their SCADA equipment. And with no with no lead time on when they're going to get equipment and get the plant back in line. So the problem at the time was that they're able to generate electricity. They just have nowhere to send it. They cannot send it into the grid because PG&E would not allow them. And so we've been working. So we've notified Armando and Trevor, who is our contact with MBARD, to let them know the issue. And we also contacted our landfill gas consultant, which is Tetra Tech, to kind of let them know the issue. And we've been in contact with OPAL and PG&E to see where we're at, you know, like almost daily, not weekly. So PG&E's response to us was that it's like a 50-day lead time for the DTT equipment and SCADA equipment, and they still don't know when they can schedule the installation and get it back online. So it's almost like indefinite. And then so we're working, and by the time PG&E and OPAL had worked out a solution, which is to change the relay settings on their breakers, OPAL had taken these breakers out during the shutdown for maintenance. So as of today, they just shipped the breakers out. They just finished repairing it.
I'm going to ask you, you said a name that took the breakers out. What was was an acronym?
OPAL. Yes. OPAL Fuels. They're the third party vendor that's running the gas collection system.
Okay. And just so for clarification, when you're talking about you have a third party vendor running your gas collection system, that's different than where you're routing the gas to. That's another vendor, the Santa Cruz Energy LLC?
They're the same.
So you refer to them as Santa Cruz Energy LLC in the documentation? I've not heard.
Oh, I'm sorry. I've been calling them OPA because they've changed their name for like a year. That's why I refer to them. But yeah.
So that's the same?
It is the same.
Okay, so I'll let you finish and then I'll ask questions. Go ahead.
Okay, so they took their breakers out to maintain them, and then they just finished repairing it and it's shipped out. It should be back on site on Wednesday, but even when the breakers are back on site, they still have to install it. They still have to run the test that of the settings that PG&E gave them, and PG&E has to okay it. So we don't know when that's gonna happen. In the meantime, we've been working with Tetra Tech Bass to get a temporary flare, submit all the application, and then that's when we learned that we have to get a variance for the open flare because it is the quickest solution to this immediate problem of landfill gas migration, which is why we're here. We're asking for variance for us to operate the open flare so then we can mitigate this problem as soon as possible, because PG&E and OPAL, I don't know when their equipment's gonna come back on, but we have a chance to take control of the gas and prevent the migration and, you know, bring the site back into compliance is kind of where we're at.
Thank you for that. Are there any questions?
Yeah, so my question is, if you weren't going to burn it off or ignite it, it would just go up into the atmosphere. Is that right?
Yeah.
So that's what you're trying to do. You're trying to
collect it back. Yeah.
Thank you.
So along those lines, I know staff's going to give a report, but I'm going to actually preemptively ask a few questions that you can either answer now or make sure you answer when the report. So they're required to have a collection system. So in your view, they're asking for relief for a flare, a variance for a flare, but what's going on with the collection right now, and aren't they out of compliance not having collection because they're required to either have a flare or a burner in place? They have to have more than collection and have to do something with that gas. Are they not out of compliance right now?
Yes, they are out of compliance. I think it's in the application they were issued a violation for not operating a gas collection and control system continuously.
Okay, so they're not operating it. Does that mean they're able to sequester it somehow under pressure underground, or is it?
No. So as Hoy mentioned, the landfill gas will either migrate to the perimeter of the landfill or it can escape through the surface. Whichever place it can go, that's where the gas will go.
Okay, and I'm going to go into this more later after the report, but I'm like shocked to hear that there's a power system without a flare as part of the permit to begin with, like Monterey landfill, which does it all under one corporate entity of a jurisdictional government entity, but they don't have any of this split stuff. And they came in here when they were having problems with their power generation system for a different reason, had to do with a constituents of the burn exhaust with the sulfur mm-hmm. from the sheetrock, but yep. It's straightforward because it's all one entity. And I'm going to talk about that further, but this is not the first time we've seen power generation split. And in my view, in a situation like this, and this is where I want to talk to council more. And here's where we have a luxury, I believe. We have a sort of an interim or emergency variance now, and we have about 2 or 3 weeks before we come back. So questions like I'm raising, I don't have to let stop this today, because we'll have an opportunity to come back and find out what's going on in a few weeks.
Correct.
But this situation does raise questions. I believe people split stuff out for reasons of tax advantageous things and special circumstances with the power generation company doesn't have to have certain stuff because they're a power generation subsystem that's not part of the landfill, I think, because they have a different permit and they're slightly different requirements. But then when something goes amiss, it gets, I'll say charitably, confusing, because you have different permits at play. And one of the things I want for sure in the next package, and I'd like to get added to the package of this record so that we can all have it sent to us, is the permits for the power station and, you know, the authorities to construct and the permits and what they've got there. I'd like to kind of see how it is that we've got a system without a maintenance flare or anything. Unless I'm misunderstanding, they're talking about getting in a flare, and I noticed that on page 120 of the agenda package, you've got an exemplary gas to energy process that is noted is from some other place that shows a gas collection line and a flare right there. So can you confirm for me that we definitely don't have that in this circumstance?
We definitely do not have a flare existing in this circumstance.
How many landfills do you think you have under your authority that you've seen in this three-county jurisdiction?
This is the only one that doesn't have a flare.
That's why you already got to my next question. This, to me, is something fundamentally questionable about this circumstance. And the idea of a solution being a temporary flare, I do see that they're looking for a permanent flare. But yeah, this seems to me like it slipped through a crack somehow in the original permit. And then, of course, something goes wrong. Okay, so with that start, now you kind of know some of the questions I have. Please, can we have the staff report?
Sure. I'm Amy Climo. I'm the Engineering Compliance Manager here at the Monterey Bay Air Resources District, and I'll provide a brief oral report. I also have Mary Gerardo and Armando Jimenez here to help with additional questions. So continuous operation of landfill gas collection and control system is necessary to prevent escape of landfill gas into the atmosphere or offsite migration. Uncontrolled releases of landfill gas can create health and safety concerns. At the City of Landfill, as we've talked, a third party operates the gas collection and control system. And at this system, the engine is considered the landfill gas control device. And the engine's combustion process thermally destroys the compounds in the landfill gas. Methane is required to be converted at a 99% destruction efficiency, and it's converted to carbon dioxide. The combustion process of the engine also creates emissions of criteria pollutants. And examples of criteria pollutants are oxides of nitrogen or NOx, carbon monoxide, or volatile organic compounds. MBART implements and enforces federal and state regulations specific to landfill gas collection and control to minimize methane emissions from landfills. We typically don't regulate greenhouse gases. This just happens to be one of the sources that we do. Our local regulations, however, are used to control criteria pollutant emissions from equipment used at the landfill, like the engine. There's no requirement in federal, state, or local rules or regulations for a landfill gas control device to have a backup. We reviewed the city's permit application to operate an open flare during the extended engine downtime period, which started in February. We found the state landfill methane regulation allows for temporary operation of an open flare. However, after reviewing the application, we found an open flare exceeds our Rule 207 threshold of 25 pounds per day of NOx, which triggers the requirement for best available control technology, or BACT. And the open flare is estimated to emit 67 pounds of NOx per day. And an enclosed flare is the required BACT to comply with Rule 207. Due to the potential environmental and public safety impacts from landfill gas emissions to the atmosphere or offsite migration, the uncertainty of when PG&E repairs will be completed, and the allowance to temporarily operate an open flare in state law, MBART supports a variance to allow operation of the open flare in violation of Rule 207 NOx limits. And there's a few other items I just want to mention. Due to the requirement to continuously operate a landfill gas collection and control system, operation of the open flare cannot be limited. It has to be allowed to operate continuously. We did issue the city a violation for continuously for failing to continuously operate the landfill gas collection control system in violation of the state regulation. Public agencies are exempt from paying excess emissions fees. This is no excess emission fees due. Operation of the open flare is not expected to create a nuisance. And the interim variance term will begin at the date of application, which is April 5th, and will extend until the regular variance hearing, which is anticipated to be May 10th, but the interim variance cannot last more than 90 days. That concludes my report.
Thank you for that. I have a few questions. So when you have a spinning turbine burning gas, viewed as the most efficient way of burning the gas, my experience, I mean, I have a mechanical engineering background and I've done plenty of jet turbines in my life. And I think you said something about 99% in those. And it's interesting what you said. So I looked at 95.464 and it says you either have to have a flare or you have to have some other kind of device. It doesn't say you have to have a backup flare, as you mentioned.
Yes.
But it does say you have to be compliant at all times to capture, which means that if you go to a backup device, you better have a flare, because otherwise, if it goes down, you will violate another code section. So without requiring a backup flare, I would say that the rules infer that you have to have one in order to comply with other aspects of code, and that's probably why we see them in every other circumstance. Is that far-fetched thinking that I'm giving you?
I don't think we've ever forced a person to come with equipment that they don't own. So when somebody's proposing something, that's when they come to us with their, but there isn't anything that mandates that they have to have the backup.
Right, but when they have a problem like this, then we can say here at the hearing board, I told you so, but we weren't issuing it to the board because the board is the overall board and they may not be having this discussion, but since it's the only one we know of, it's not something we have to, I think, identify up to the board as perhaps a rule, because it's just the last lingering one, as far as you know, every other circumstance. So that was one question, is I can see in the code that they don't require it, but they do require compliance. And good practice would tell me that you should have a flare all this time, because it's fully foreseeable that your power generation system is going to go down one way or the other, to me. But I don't set policy. Then I had another question about the 99% then in the spinning turbine that you mentioned. I see stuff in the applicant's or the petitioner's materials that it seems to infer that they're going to get 98% on this flare. Are you in a position to talk about your efficiencies on your flare burn?
I think Tetra Tech would be the...
Pardon me?
Oh, sorry. Our consultant, Tetra Tech, would be the experts on that.
And are they on the line and under oath?
Yes.
So I'll just start by saying I'd be happy to learn something new, but if I read right that you're expecting 98% of burn through a open flare, I would be surprised. And did I misread that? And what are we representing? And I guess also ask staff, did I misread that their technical material says 98% burn on their open flare? Because it caught my eye immediately that seems unrealistically high, but I'd be happy to be proved wrong. There might be something about this flare. I might be out of date on flare technology.
If you like, I could give a brief presentation on the difference between an open and enclosed.
Yes, please.
Can you? It's the second photo. It's the second slide. Okay, so I think in this case, a picture is worth 1,000 words. On the left-hand side is what we call an open or a candlestick flare, and it is the simplest of flare designs. Basically, both systems require a blower, and they pull that vacuum and deliver the gas. In the open candlestick flare, the gas travels all the way to the tip of the pipe. And at the tip of the pipe, there are, it's a pilot light, and that ignites the gas, which then creates the flame. And that's it. The operator really has no control of the system. And it's stated that on low calm days, these should control the non-methane and methane gases by 98%. The problem with these designs is if there are high wind conditions, you're going to create an unstable flame, which will lower the temperature. And lowering the temperature may result in lower destruction efficiencies. Whereas on the enshrouded or the enclosed flare, the operator has much more control of the combustion process. To optimize combustion, it's known as the three T's. You want to control turbulence, temperature, and time. Turbulence is controlled by the fact that the way they design the burners, they can control the flame length, flame patterns, and then they also can control the amount of oxygen so that they also have control of the temperature in an enclosed flare. And lastly, by the nature of where the combustion occurs to the top of the stack, that time it takes to travel, you're getting the time, it's called 0.6 second retention time. So by the nature of having more control, these flares at a minimum meet 99% and even up to 99.9. So you're gonna get greater efficiency. The other advantages to an enclosed flare is the fact that by the nature of the enclosure, reducing noise and you're reducing the light that might create a public nuisance. And lastly, and pretty important, is you can't see it, but there's two ports on the side of that stack. So we can actually source test an enclosed flare, and we can confirm they're meeting their requirements, where that is clearly not possible in an open candlestick flare.
Very informative. Perhaps I don't need to hear from your special. We're just understanding that at times it's going to be inefficient. And I'm assuming that a short-term open flare is used because you don't do short-term closed flares. They're not the same technology that can just be shipped in quickly, or am I misunderstanding that?
I think there are available portable open flares, correct.
So can I ask, available open flares, but not closed flares? Let me just ask, did you look into portable short-term closed flares as well?
They're not as easy and quick as an open flare, which again, we're trying to mitigate this issue immediately. Yeah, it takes a lot more design for an enclosed flare as well.
I'm gonna go to public comments in a second, but I've dominated, I'm sorry, Emmett. Why?
You know, I don't really have any questions, but moving forward, would you have a closed system as your backup?
Yes, we plan to design a closed flare for like a permanent system so that this doesn't happen.
Thank you. That's no more questions.
So the closed flare becomes part of a different permit or part of their permit, isn't it? Isn't the combustion system on its own permit?
So the city of Santa Cruz actually only has a Title V federal permit for the landfill. Mm-hmm. A flare would be a separate permit issued just to the city, but because we cannot permit, it doesn't meet our requirements for Rule 207. We can't permit an open flare. We have to allow it to operate under the variance.
But we can condition a long-term variance,
yes,
on them putting one in as a permanent solution.
Correct.
And that was a question, not a... Not
I
a,
see.
That
yes.
Was, it sounded like an affirmative statement. I'm hoping that that's true.
Yes, and I think they outlined a timeline. I don't remember but there's a timeline in their application that they're moving towards installing.
And that's a question I'm hoping our council can affirm for us before our hearing in 2 weeks. That I believe we have the authority, but we have the authority to condition a long-term permit on them seeking and receiving a closed flare, perhaps installing a closed flare as a solution.
I just have a couple quick questions before we move on. So I know we might have touched on this. Demio Lane, this is the official dump for the city of Santa Cruz.
Yes.
Sometimes people get confused of the cement plant and the dump. Second question is, you mentioned that there's a third party, Opal Cliffs. What are they doing to help mitigate this problem as we speak? I mean, is there anybody here from the third party or?
I don't think they're here. I think at some point they are working with PG&E, which is why they're able to negotiate, putting some changes to their breakers in order to, I guess, mimic the PG&E equipment that was damaged. But again, during the shutdown, they thought this would be a good maintenance opportunity. They took out what needed to be set, and it is off-site, it's not on-site. Yeah. It just got repaired and it's being shipped back.
Next question is, you might have touched on it right now too. What is being done by the City of Santa Cruz and PG&E to prevent this from happening again? I know once in a while we have strong winds. So what is the city doing in the consultant or PG&E to make sure this doesn't happen again? Because this seems like a pretty big problem.
I can't speak PG&E. I mean, but this is why we're asking for this variance, for this long-term variance, so that, you know, in the meantime, while the enclosed permanent solution is being designed, we can operate the open flare just in case this happens again.
So the City of Santa Cruz is working on a planning, on a permanent solution as we speak?
We're trying to get, we're trying to procure the solution for the long-term, the enclosed flare, because it requires design, so it has to go through a procurement process.
Yeah, because in this email from a City Councilmember Sandy Brown, it says there's a critical need for a temporary solution, and, you know, on this board, we're just kind of, yes, this temporary solution is always good, but then we also want to see what's the next step for permits. So I just, those are my questions. Thank you.
And I did ask that we get to see the power generation permits into the record, please. I mean, I tried to find out what I could about them, but it seemed like I didn't have access to the right corporate records. They're Delaware Incorporated Corporation that is headquartered now in Texas. Is that your understanding, or you work directly with these people?
We do. I mean, you know, we talk occasionally, and we talk when reports are due. And on the operation side, we help each other when we have to put in horizontal wells. But I thought their headquarters was in New York. I'm not sure.
They have a address in New York as well. Anyway, so they're clearly out of town. One of the things that I see, and when we had the Sand City power generation was running on natural gas. There's so much dust in Sand City that all their filters got overwhelmed and they started burning all out of spec. This was, as far as I could see, just part of a big manufacturing facility. In the old days, a manufacturing facility would have within it natural gas powered electrical generators with gas turbines. And until very recently, that was considered a green solution. People got pushed into natural gas to, because the electrical power generation was so dirty. And now a lot of them, but anyway, there's a lot of tax advantages. There's initial subsidies, there's tax breaks. So instead of the plant having its own generation, the power generation was just outside. And even though it only had one customer and it should have been all, in conceptually it's all one unit, they're independent. But then as soon as they start having problems, this place is having problems. This is the place that needs relief, because the power company could just shut down until they're fixed. This is, to me, another example of an independent power company, which I'm only gonna guess because it started in 96 and I don't know what the tax structure was, but it comes in as a partner to the city because they're making very likely tremendous tax and advantages as an independent small power generation company. And then the question is, when something like this goes wrong, they didn't put in a flare to begin with, they're a power generation company, the city's getting saddled with costs. It just makes me wonder what the exact, and I don't need officially to know, but what is the contractual relationship the city has with this place? And the things that Mr. Dodge just brought up, how robust is the interface to PG&E, which is outside of the city's control, but it blows back to the city when something goes wrong. And this can't be an inexpensive endeavor that you're going on to get this equipment in there. I just can't believe it's that inexpensive.
So again, this is a contract that was from like 1984, but it is expiring at the end of September. So new terms could be, you know, I mean, especially in light of what's happening.
So now I'm going to go to ask anyone who's here from the public, either online or in person, if they would like to speak. And I will caution anyone that likes to speak as a member of the public, they will have to go under oath if they're not already under oath. Is there anyone that would like to speak?
One online No one in the boardroom. We did receive one comment, public comment.
I actually wanted to go over some of the findings we're required to make real briefly and point out how in a circumstance like this, in my view, they're extremely problematic to make, and this is where I wanted to bring in counsel, but I think that it's a thing where we really need to have counsel in two and a half weeks, because here we're only required to make a finding that we're likely to be able to make these findings. It's in 2.5 weeks where we have to make these findings, which is much more resolute. And even though I have a question about whether you can make it in the absence of counsel telling me otherwise, hi, Reed, you're there now. It was going to be easier for me to say this without you being there, but I was going to say in the absence of counsel direction, and we could get it in the intervening couple of weeks. One of the questions that I have about a condition is, there's certain conditions we have to make to grant these variances, no ifs, ands, or buts, and we get overseen by the state, and doesn't serve anyone to cut corners on these. And we should definitely talk about them. But the one that's tricky here is, due to conditions beyond the reasonable control of the petitioner, requiring compliance would result in either an arbitrary or unreasonable taking of property or the practical closing of a lawful business. We shut you down, you still produce gas. Like, there's no applicability of this finding to this circumstance, which kind of says to me, we can't make that finding. But I'm going to let our counsel give us some guidance on that, hopefully in 2 weeks when we have to make that finding. So do you understand, Reed, that I could see that this can't be the first time that this comes up. So there's got to be some guidance for boards in our situation. And is there a chance that you would have time to maybe to look into that a little bit and give us some guidance about how to potentially non-applicable finding gets addressed in an order like this?
Absolutely. I'm happy to take a look at that. I think you could take a couple of approaches just off the top without having researched it. But the first one that comes to mind is reading it in a manner that is consistent with the second sentence that talks about when there is a public agency as the applicant or the petitioner and what type of special considerations you would need to include in your evaluation and analysis. I think that speaks to the operation of a lawful business. Well, a resource conservation recycling facility, I think that's the name of the Santa Cruz facility, is a lawful business. And I don't think it's a terrible stretch to read the second sentence there that talks about considering whether that has an impact on an essential public service and to make a determination that this would be an appropriate circumstance that you could use and rely on making that finding. And if there is an issue with it not actually fitting within that, you can set aside certain findings when they're not applicable. I've gone through this with another agency very recently where there's statutory requirements, you shall consider the following, but when item D has no relation to the application, how do you assess it? Well, you set it to the side. You don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. You just don't apply that particular one. So I'm happy to look at that further, but at this point, and as you've identified, it isn't necessarily the issue today. It'll be an issue in a couple of weeks.
In fact, you've already given me ammunition for support for today, because it appears that there's likely to be a way through that, and all we're doing today is making a finding that we're highly likely to be able to do this in a few weeks. And would you also might be able to give us some guidance at that time about in a written order how one addresses that?
Yeah, I'll be sure to work with staff if we prepare something along those lines to make sure that it does reflect an appropriate finding as crafted.
And so in the meantime, I don't know if you've seen the prepared findings for this interim variance. Would you recommend that be addressed at this level, or that we're comfortable in light of this discussion to leave it as is for the interim findings?
Yeah, I think based on it being an interim variance at this point, the language that's proposed is consistent with what the statute requires, and I would leave it as is. When we return in a couple of weeks, hopefully we can have a clearer path, and we'll be addressing the direct language there.
Super. Any questions for counsel? Any further questions? Well, we have a draft order. I think everybody's seen it. I'll just ask staff if, in light of everything that they've heard today, that they're comfortable with this draft as we've got it.
Yes.
Okay. We need a unanimous vote to approve the draft motion. We'd first the draft order, we'd first need a motion.
Go ahead and make the motion. We support this variance.
And I'll second it.
Okay. Let's move on.
All right. Chair Guth? Yes. Director Dodge?
Yes.
Director Linder?
Yes.
Approve unanimously.
Thank you all for coming. You're likely to do a little tying up of stuff in 2 weeks, but you're always see what it is that way. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to go to the next item, which is, and it's a shame we didn't get a chance to see this last month or earlier this month, but an update on, well, I'll say item five. Siri, I'll turn over item five introduction to you.
I'm sorry. All right. Number five, receive oral update on docket number 23-005, order for abatement against Lovesworth Holdings, Inc., DBA, First Stop and Go Valero, owner Samuel Azibi.
Good afternoon. Amy Climo, Engineering Compliance Manager. Just wanted to provide you with an update on this abatement order. The matter is not resolved. March 27th, we emailed Mr. Azibi a reminder that the outstanding amount of $6,141 was due to comply with the abatement order, and we had not received it. And this amount was due by April 13th. On Monday, April 15th, we issued a violation for failing to comply with the abatement order, and our next steps are working with our counsel to continue to address this.
Thank you for that report. I know that we were hoping to perhaps get some, was either the 12th or the 5th was our original meeting. We were going to try to see if we could find out something had been done within the time period of our authority so that we could perhaps at least discuss it in some relief if there would have been a huge leap because there had been an inspection that had already been passed at that point.
Yeah.
But was there any attempt to make any payments? I think, or was it a situation where they could only make the full payment?
Mr. Azibi came in January and he asked to make, to break up the payments over 6 months, and that was not approved. And so we stuck with the original order that said he needed to pay that additional $6,141 by April 13th, and we did not receive that payment.
So further, if I recall, and I'm sorry, I don't have last month's package, but wasn't there a date by which our authority ceased?
April 13th.
And that has now stopped.
Yes. And that's why we issued the violation on the 15th.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it goes to the attorney.
I just wanted to hear that we're timed out of it. And so it's appropriate. We're not in any way on the hook for any kind of action other than to just hear the report. So thank you very much for the report. Is that counsel, is that how you see it? We just received this report and we're
yes, done. That's fine. And I did want to also say that I do have to step away now because I have another board that's about to start their LAFCO meeting at 3:00. So if you did have any questions for me on any of the items on the agenda, I've got another few minutes here before I have to appear in another location at the same time.
We were going to do the new draft minutes, and if you really only have 5 minutes, I'm going to jump ahead before we even have a preparation to tell you some things that have caught my eye that I need. I would like you to support looking into with recommendations, and hopefully it's not inappropriate that we also take it online after the meeting that I could send you some of these.
Absolutely.
First of all, I mean, I got to start since I'm going to go to the critique. It's all great, but one of the questions is, and I brought this up before, is whether who is a party? We have 378 evidence. Each party shall have these rights to call and examine witnesses. What it appears to me is that there's no differentiation between the hearings procedure and protocols for when it's like some aggressive abatement order or something like that versus a person coming in for a variance. And that may be appropriate, but So each party shall have the right to call witnesses. We're comfortable with that. City of Santa Cruz could have called any staff member, and as long as we're good with that. One of the questions, though, is each party shall have these rights. Is the board a party? There's a list of who the parties are in the definitions, and they say the resource district, but I don't think that the staff views us as part of their district, really, because they won't talk to us about what they're thinking. They'll just give us information. So one of the questions for you, we don't need an answer today, even if you have it. Who's a party? Are we a party? Because I want to make absolutely sure that these rules make it clear that we as a board can call anybody we want. Anybody who's in this room, even we can bring up anybody. And they're close to that, but it's not crystal clear. And I will send in writing to you all where I think there could be some polishing, because all this stuff comes up when it's a acrimonious hearing, which we haven't had yet. We got to do it all when we're all on the same page. So the other thing that I really have a problem with is 3710 continuances. To me, once there's been a noticed hearing, I don't believe that it's appropriate for two members of the board somehow to be able to give a continuance. I don't know where that comes from, and there might be good reason, but that's surprising to me. It seems like it has to come into session, and you need a majority to grant a continuance. If we have a five-person board, two people can't do it. That's how I see it. It would have to be in session. This has come up in things in planning commissions I've been on, where somebody wants to continue something because they think they're going to have a contentious hearing. They know there's a lot of members of the public going to be there. That may be a little out of our normal exposure, but the idea that two people on a board could continue something when it's a noticed hearing, it doesn't say that it's continuance only for a non-noticed hearing. Without a noticed hearing, there's no continuance. I'd like that to be looked at further, and I'm not comfortable with two members granting a, because if you're in session, it takes a majority to do something, and that could be three. So anyway, so that's another one, and maybe there's a background on that makes sense. But once again, especially, you have quorum. Three members of the hearing board shall constitute a quorum. No action shall be taken except in the presence of a quorum. Do we, Reed, want to have a list of in these bylaws, or do we want to defer to a state section that says how many people you need to vote? If you have a quorum, the vote majority needs to be based upon the total number of seats filled or unfilled, or quorum or not quorum, or maybe not. I think we should flesh that out. Even if we're going to refer to state sections, they should be in here. Because there's going to be a time when it's going to become a problem. So if anything for Reed before we let him go? I'll send you that in writing too, Reed.
Yeah, I see a section, just I don't know if you made a tag of it, but 3.15, which says that no decision shall be made except in the presence of a quorum and on an affirmative vote of three members, which sort of speaks to me about you're going to need your three out of five every time. And so changing the continuance to just saying a majority seems like a simple switch there. But I got those notes, and shoot me anything else you like. I'll be sure to talk to Amy and the other staff when we have a chance.
And then a question for you, if we as board members want to send to staff some comments, should we just do that individually without copying others because it's been an agendized item?
Yes, that would be the best practice.
Okay. So thank you, Reed. I'm going to open up this discussion more, but I think where we're going is, since we have a meeting in just 2 weeks and there are some questions, we try to have a finished version then. Is that conflict with anything you guys are doing?
No, that would be great. I think we discussed these items back in October. And so we'd love to have a resolution on this because we'd like to take it to our board in June to get it fully adopted and get this new version on the books.
If we weren't on the record, I mentioned about where's the part about the catered roast beef with horseradish. I'm only kidding. It's been a long hearing. I'm only kidding. So I'll start with your comments on, or should we share for a second why we're doing this? See you, Reed. We all remember now, I'll just remind us all, our three county district used to be below a certain population. And when you're below a certain population, you can do things a certain way. I don't know if it's 750,000 or whatever it is, and we went above in the last sentence. And all of a sudden, all of the old days of you having a hearing at home on your telephone, one person for that, are behind us now. And our bylaws simply have to be updated to reflect that. That was the original impetus. But then we also noticed there was a lot of other stuff that really wasn't discussed. And so
you were working with staff.
Well, staff did the work. They went to other, they used their gumption, and they also checked other adjacent larger boards and piecemeal together a really, really good draft. But we're tasked with finding anything that might catch our eye. And you, if it catches your eye, you should bring it up. And there might be a reason why it's that way, but it might be that you're actually catching something that doesn't make sense. Because we're not uncallable, right, over there? Yeah.
No.
And some of the things might one conflict with the other. So that was the background. And this is sort of our last chance, not in this hearing, but in this coming couple of weeks, our last chance to feed any concerns to staff or bring them to our hearing. So let me see if this was a hearing. Let me see how we did the nature of this.
No, we just had it as a, we wanted, it was just an agenda item to adopt the regulation. So we'll bring it back in May.
Well, just to cover a base, even though I know it says adopt.
Action.
Yeah, it's, I'm going to go through the motion of asking if there's any member of the public that would like to speak on this item, either online or in person.
It's raised online and no one in the room.
I don't see one. So I also am thinking that it might be appropriate because adopt is an action. We have a motion to continue this to the next meeting.
Yes, I'd like to make a motion. We continue this item to update, I believe, our procedure before the hearing board.
And so for continuation, you can either do it to a date uncertain, it has to be renoticed, or a date certain, which it doesn't. So what I've asked if you could modify your motion to make it to our May something. What's our
10th?
Could you continue it, please?
If I'd like to make a motion that we put the item of adopting a hearing board regulation number 6 to our May 11th.
10th.
May 10th meeting.
Okay, I'll just do a voice vote. All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Thank you. Before I adjourn, I'll ask anyone have anything they'd like to say on any topic?
No one online, nothing received.
Siri, there, Michael. I'm so that.